You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to a new episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Once again, I'm here with my good friend Maggie, and we'll be talking about movies, TV series, books, possibly theatre, video games, any kind of culture that caught our attention over the last couple of weeks. How have you been doing, Maggie?
I'm great, thanks. I am trying to watch as many movies as possible because it's my hobby to avoid the World Cup, you know. It's my mission to avoid the World Cup. I'm just not made for that.
Yeah, I definitely back you up on that one.
Yes.
It's, I don't know, football, I mean, this is something I'm going to share with the internet now. I actually, as a kid, I spent several years playing in a football club. And by playing, I mean sitting on the bench and being put on the field for 5 minutes at the end and hating every second of it.
Yeah.
So I'm traumatized. It's just football for me is evil. So I try to avoid it. And like you, I basically very much prefer movies, TV series, books, or just, you know, hanging out, having some coffee, having some wine, but not watch and not think about football.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. And I think football in Putin's Russia is doubly evil, but we shouldn't get too political here because that might lead to problems, you know.
I mean, we were not going to rename this podcast into A Damn Fine Cup of Politics, which sounds horrible to begin with.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds bitter and, you know, like a double espresso that's been boiling for too long.
It insinuates things that aren't there.
Exactly. So what have you seen recently or read that really caught your attention?
Well, I found out fairly late that Sam Shepard's last book was already published in December. It's a short novel, maybe a novella. It's called Spy of the First Person. It's a really rather unusual title for a Sam Shepard book, but it becomes clear really soon in the text what he wants to do. There's an old man sitting in a rocking chair on a porch. Sometimes he's drinking, sometimes he's sleeping, sometimes he's looking at the landscape.
That is very unusual for Sam Shepard, yeah, isn't it?
No, it's basically vintage, I think, but that man realizes he's being watched by another man. And I already told you the title, Spy of the First Person. Of course, it's the same guy. It's himself watching himself as a slightly younger man, as a still able-bodied man, because the man in the rocking chair, he's got ALS, the same thing that Sam Shepard had when he died. And it's basically, you know, David Bowie sort of said goodbye with his last records, with what was it called, Black Star, I think.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that Sam Shepard did the same thing with Spy of the First Person. He wrote the first chapters of the novel himself, and then ALS prevented that, and he dictated the latter chapters to his family, to his kids. It's about the area where the novella is set. I think it's California, with its trees and birds and cultivations. And that bit is also some kind of let's visit Shepherd Country one last time, you know, with all its nature impressions and everything. Not much happens in the novel, but the two men have some kind of rapport, and I think Sam Shepard is looking tenderly at himself, but also very realistically at himself. Yeah, I've got ALS. I'm not going to make it into, you know, 2019 or something. I didn't read it. I listened to it as an audiobook, and it was read by none other than Michael Shannon. It could have been a freak show. It could have been weird and slow, but I think Michael Shannon sort of finds the right tone for the text, and I was positively surprised. I was sort of skeptical when I read that Michael Shannon would read it, because he could have laid any kind of suggestion in the text. He could have suggested darker things in the text, but it's really well done. It works on the page, but it also works as an audiobook. Yeah, and that's it. At some point, it's just, it doesn't have an end. It's basically, it's just over, and that's it. It got published after Shepard's death, and I think it's somehow weirdly befitting that it's that kind of text and not a play or anything.
Okay, no, it sounds interesting. Yeah. I think the thing with Michael Shannon is, I mean, I know what you mean, but I also think that the kind of the Michael Shannon trademarked weirdness is also very much tied into how the guy looks. I mean, in, mm-hmm. I would say 9 out of 10 things where he acts, he's just got this intense bug-eye look.
Yeah.
That just, you know, you could even, you know, just switch off the sound, just put on subtitles and you'd still have the Michael Shannon effect.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you kind of, you know, kind of switched off the image and just listened to him, it would be very, very different.
Yeah.
You know, if they did one of those audio description versions of a Michael Shannon movie, the audio descriptions would be, he looks at you intensely with those weird bug eyes for about half the time.
Yeah.
So I could imagine that he works very differently if you just hear him.
He does. He does. Maybe it helps if you don't know what Michael Shannon looks like. maybe the book is sort of more consoling and more mellow if you go for that kind of thing. But I can definitely recommend it. I can recommend the book and the audiobook both.
Sounds good. I should really get into audiobooks a bit more. It's, I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts, especially when I cook, but every now and then it would be nice to listen to an audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm currently reading Lincoln in the Bardo, and I've also got the audiobook for when I've finished reading the book, because I hear it's a very, very good audiobook, mm-hmm. very high production values, good actors. But yeah, most of the time it's just another episode of This American Life. But yeah, definitely curious about getting into audiobooks a bit more. And with something like that, with Sam Shepard, where you've got a very strong sense of a voice, I could imagine that it works especially. You know, even if it's a book, if it's a novel, there's still this theatrical or dramatic angle to it, I think, very often with his writing.
Yeah, there is. There is, yeah. And what have you been reading, watching, seeing? Thinking about?
Well, I mean, as I said, I've been reading Lincoln in the Bardo, but I don't want to talk about that one yet because I'm only about halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I have to say that I've been watching episodes here and there. We started watching Arrested Development, which I enjoy, which is rare because comedies are something that is tricky with me. But I haven't really watched any films since, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks ago when we went to see The Third Murder, the Corriere that I blogged about.
Yeah.
It's just, I've been traveling for work, my wife's been traveling for work, and I think then I don't necessarily kind of save the movies I'm most looking forward to for when we're both a bit exhausted, because it's better then to watch the stuff that we're kind of interested in, but it doesn't matter if it turns out not to be that great.
Yeah.
So instead, what I'll perhaps quickly talk about is a couple of weeks ago, there was this theatre festival in Bern, Aua wir leben, which roughly translates into ouch or ow, we're alive. I also posted something about one of the plays that we saw there, Campo Minado, Minefield, an Argentinian-British co-production. But I think I want to generally talk about festivals. I have to say that I'm the kind of guy who, when I read books, when I see films, when I watch TV series, very often I've already read reviews. I've definitely read what it's about. I know the IMDb entry kind of by heart, which is, it's just how it is for me. I'm very rarely surprised by films because I already know what to expect. Same with TV series and books. And that's actually one of the reasons why I really like the kind of festival format when it comes along. You know, we've got this theatre festival once a year here in Bern. We sometimes go to Edinburgh for the Fringe Festival. There's a Buskers Festival also in Bern that mm-hmm. we have. And what I like about this is basically that, okay, you read, I don't know, a 3-line summary of who's going to perform, what it's about, but that very rarely gives you a concrete idea of what you're going to see.
Yeah.
And I like having the chance of just walking into 2, 3, 4 different things, not really knowing what to expect and being surprised. Sometimes that surprise is that it's really bad. Sometimes the surprise is that it's really good. And sometimes the surprise is just that it's completely different from what you expected.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It might be similar if I ever went to a movie festival, but I find that with films, I more quickly feel after a film, okay, I've seen this film, now I don't need to go to the cinema for the next week, and then I'm back at the cinema. It's plays are usually shorter, but they're also more direct somehow, so they're more immediate. And that, I think, live performances works really well for me for this kind of festival format where you just put your hand into the bag and, you know, pull out four or five, you know, things at random, more or less. And that I really like. What about you? I mean, do you ever go to festivals? What kind of festivals do you like?
Well, I'm very much fond of our Wir Leben. I've missed it this year, I have to confess. But around here, it's really very hard to get into any kind of theater other than just the traditional state-sponsored or popular private theater. Experimental theater, new theater with an experimental touch to it. I don't mean completely experimental, but just something new, something with youngish people and new subject matter and everything. You have to travel around here, except for the Aua Wir Leben, I think. It's convenient because it's close. I really like that one, not least because we know people who have their hand in the organization of it. But you can really, really surprise yourself, as you said. I always have a look at the program and then I pick two or three shows and then I go there. And mostly I'm really pleasantly surprised at what it does, what it does to me. Sometimes it's just not for me, and it can also be really badly done, in my opinion. But mostly it's exciting, it's fun, it's something that you wouldn't otherwise see with that kind of effect or anything. For instance, there was, I don't remember her name, 2 years ago, I saw a woman talking into a microphone. It was some kind of essay, but also some kind of performance. Parts of it didn't work, but she was really smart. She was talking about love and relationships in general. And the whole room was full of deck chairs and free beers in huge buckets full of ice. And that really worked. I thought that was something new. And I am pretty sure the next 5 years, a show like that won't come to Bern, except for the Aua Wir Leben Festival. So if you want to surprise yourself, if you're open to that kind of thing, go there. But I'm also a big fan of what is generally called the normal traditional theater, you know, Shakespeare and Ibsen. And sometimes once a year I have an itch to see an opera and then I go and see it. And then I go and see an opera. Why not? But that festival, I was sorry to have missed it, I have to say, which means I'm going to go next year.
And see twice as many things.
Of course, yeah. I have withdrawal symptoms.
Yep. But I think for this month, we're planning to mainly talk about something that is, I'm not actually sure, is it far from theater or is there a theatrical element to it? I mean, we're going to the Wild Wild West and I'm not talking about Will Smith, right?
No, we're not talking about Will Smith. Westworld is some kind of stage, if you like. For those who don't know what it is, I'll shortly describe it. It's a huge, a very big theme park, a Western-style theme park. You can go there and you can be a cowboy, you can be a are there any gold diggers? There probably are, but I'm not sure whether I've seen. You can have a gun, you can have a horse. You're even allowed to rob a bank, rob a train, or even shoot people. And there are so-called hosts. And these hosts are, shall we call them robots? What's the proper designation? They're artificial intelligence and they look real. They feel real.
Basically, I think androids is what a kind of sci-fi geek would call them. Mm-hmm. Or replicant, possibly.
Yeah. And most of them don't know that they're replicants, right? That's only a very mild spoiler, but most of them don't know that they're androids or machines.
Exactly.
Or have I given away everything right now?
Well, I think it's if you do anything in that kind of genre, I think that's always the big question, you know. Are these things self-aware? Are they even things? Are they people? What does that mean? What is consciousness? That's the word I think it is, not conscience, because they're definitely often without conscience. I think you have that in things like Blade Runner, of course. You've got it in Ex Machina. You've got it in, I think, also in series like Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, yeah.
As, you know, we create these artificial beings, and at what point are they more than just puppets whose strings we pull? At mm-hmm. what point do they cut their strings or just realize that they are strings and we're the ones pulling them?
Yeah.
So did you like it?
No. On the whole, no, I didn't like it. It's hard for me to... I don't know exactly how to approach artificial intelligence. I found it very hard caring about the artificial characters for several reasons. For instance, some days they repeat themselves and they are not absolutely the same, but they're very, very similar. And some characters, some artificial characters, some androids, they die several times. If they do that, it's hard to sort of care for them because you know that they will be rebooted, probably, and then they will appear again. So not only are they not, don't know exactly how to put that, their appearance can be repeated even if they die. So, mm-hmm. so the degree I care for them automatically diminishes in a way. Plus, mm-hmm. Plus you can sort of reboot them to your liking. You can make them more adventurous. You can make them more shy, less shy, faster, audacious. You can give them leadership. You can also take it away again. And if you sort of don't fall for their outer appearance, what is there? What's left in an AI character like Maeve or Dolores or any of the men? I forget the names right now. Teddy, for instance.
I mean, the men are also less interesting, I think, in the series. I think the series definitely is more interested in I think, interesting, complex, and strong female mm-hmm. AI characters.
That is one of the very good aspects. It's definitely a series with... not exactly with more women than men. I mean, it's still the West, but the women that are in the series are almost always slightly more interesting than the men. There are some male cardboard characters in Westworld, let's face it. But I just don't know what's there to sort of hang on to if those characters are artificial, if they're machines consisting basically of spare parts. It doesn't matter how modern they look, how much avant-garde technology is in there. And if they suddenly become self-aware and sort of want to overcome their makers or even the human clientele in the theme park, if they want to live a self-determined life, I can see the effort and I partly appreciate the effort, but I'm not sure if that's also not some kind of AI feature. Do you know what I mean? It's not that they become more just because they want to start some kind of revolution or an upturning of the whole host and guest society. It doesn't make them more human for me. Mm-hmm. It makes them slightly more diverse, more creative. But it's still mm-hmm. it's still within the scope of AI. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe you can convince me otherwise. It's an ongoing problem with AI and me.
I like that, AI and me. Yeah. That could almost be a film. It would probably be an Owen Wilson film. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had this conversation a couple of times. I think every time that there's a movie about, you know, artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. intelligence is becoming self-aware, I think there's a disconnect at your end, and then I try to, you know, do this. But what about this character? What about that character? If I remember correctly, I don't think you had the same degree of problem with Battlestar Galactica, where also half of the cast is Cylons, and the Cylons were created by human beings, and they're also these kind of biotechnological machines, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think with Battlestar Galactica for the longest time, most of the Cylons are also antagonists. I don't know whether that makes it easier for you.
I think it does, yeah.
But even in that one, I mean, you had characters that think they are human, that act as human, and then basically they have some kind of existential crisis when they come to realize, no, actually they're Cylons, and there might be some kind of, you know, Manchurian Candidate style programming there.
Mm-hmm. I think with the fact that I like Battlestar Galactica more is because it doesn't take place in a stereotypical setting. Battlestar Galactica is far more modern. I mean, we're in space, whereas Westworld is inevitably, at least partly, a Western. Cowboys, Indians, good guys, bad guys, saloons, fist fights, horses, hookers. It's all very standard. It's brought to you in a new way, but Battlestar Galactica does not have to sort of solve the problem how to bring something stereotypical in a new way. It already is mm-hmm. some kind of futuristic. I mean, yeah, as I said, we're in space, robots, things like that. It's already mm-hmm. it's already more advanced than we are in the year 2018. Westworld mm-hmm. goes back maybe 100, maybe 150 years, something like that. It has to deal with that past or with the allusions to the past. And that makes it sort of not clumsy, but it makes it limited and repetitive. I mean, we see Dolores waking up, or what counts for waking up in AI, 5 or 6 times. And the same is true for Maeve getting up in the morning, experiencing the same day or the same procedures on subsequent days with slight variations. I mean, I see the point in storytelling, because she, especially Maeve, is sort of coming up with a plan for getting out very slowly, very eventually, but she will get there. She will try and escape the whole Westworld thing. Every day she learns something new. At some point she realizes she can manipulate that procedure in a way, just by talking about it. But these scenes are, to me, they are, the repetitive aspect is much more obvious than the aspects that change from one day to the next. And so mm-hmm. I found myself thinking, oh, please, not that scene again. I was sort of lost. To me, it seemed like a very slow series. And mm-hmm. when it started to pick up the pace, there were always shootouts and fist fights. It's, to me, that's a very uneasy combination between standard Western scenes and scenes involving artificial intelligence that don't really work for me.
I think, you know, I mean, there's definitely, let's put it like this. I mean, you've said before that you've got a disconnect with kind of artificial characters mm-hmm. and accepting them as people, so to speak, as characters, and not just as programmed machines.
Yeah.
I mean, you've also said that you're not that much into sci-fi before, and I think that might be part of it, that mm-hmm. it's, in a way, a genre trope that, since you have an issue with the entire genre in many cases,
yep.
you find it more difficult to get into the trope. I think I have that much less, probably because, for one thing, already as a kid, I liked science fiction. I probably liked it more as a kid than I do now, but I still find it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm more familiar with the tropes, and I'm also more familiar with, in a way, what is usually done with those tropes, how are they developed, and then I kind of make the, you know, I have the suspension of disbelief, you know. Of course robots can be people, of course AIs can be real characters, because I've read and seen stories like that for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that perhaps in some ways I'm perhaps a bit more, I don't know, cynical about human beings. I think we're also programmed machines, it's just our programming is more complex. But, I mean, that's where you get into discussion about metaphysics in a way, and less about movies and TV series. I have to say that I see some of what you mean, the thing with the repetition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more of a computer gamer than you've ever been.
Yep.
And I'm someone who, I think, in general, with fiction, any kind of fiction, whether it's film, book, computer game, I like to suspend my disbelief. I think it doesn't take much for my disbelief to be suspended. You know, I accept fictional characters as characters very often, even if I know they're also written, they're constructs. But I still relate to them in a relatively emotional way as well as intellectual and critical way. And that's true for films, TV series, definitely. It's even true with computer games. But in computer games, you've got exactly that moment that you mentioned, you know. Computer games tend to, I don't know, the illusion tends to break more quickly. You know, you might follow a character in a computer game and they seem, you know, well-written, well-performed, well-animated, mm-hmm. ideally, very often they're not, but let's say ideal, best-case scenario. You might, you know, walk after this character and the character interacts with the world and they seem to exist, they seem to live. And then comes the moment where basically their programming loops, where their script goes back to the beginning, because computer games are not at a point where they can dynamically adjust much, especially if it's characters that have scripts, that have, you know, lines of dialogue. These lines of dialogue will repeat at some point, and that's also the moment where the suspension of disbelief tends to crack, if not shatter.
Mm-hmm.
You accept that that person that you've been watching in the game is real until the moment comes where they just repeat themselves. And at that point, they're like the animated pirates in the Pirates of the Caribbean theme park in Disney World or Disneyland. At that point, they just seem very primitive machines with no kind of volition. Even if they started spouting dialogue that, you know, speaks to self-awareness of and consciousness, it would be programmed. It would be no different than, you know, a book can have lines about self-awareness. That doesn't mean the book is self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Westworld, for me, it does an interesting thing. It both shows the illusion, the programming, but it also shows the moments where the programming breaks. But then it always says, but is this actually a moment where the programming changes into something more dynamic, something more evolving? Or is it just that the programming accounts for these things? You know, is the self-awareness actually something new? Is it something emergent?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just another kind of twist of the fictional screw, you know, where they programmed to look like they're self-aware? And while I find that interesting, I also think it undermines the series a bit, because I find it very easy, for instance, with the Maeve character played by Thandie Newton. I think it's a very good part. It's probably the most interesting character in the entire series and a very well-acted character.
Yeah.
But there is a moment where, you know, you've been watching her for several episodes evolving, or you think she's evolving, but then suddenly she looks at her programming and she sees even her going through the motions of evolving seem to be programmed.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes that interesting, I think, Thandie Newton, because she seems genuinely dismayed at this notion that perhaps she's still programmed. But it is that dismay programmed?
Yeah.
It's basically programmed turtles all the way down. But again, I think I mind that less, because I also think that, you know, living beings are also, they're basically biological hardware that runs on certain programs. You know, you get a stimulus, you get a reaction. Human beings are like that too. It's just that the stimuli and the reactions are much more complex. So for me, I think it's not that much of a disconnect, because I don't think we're fundamentally different, other than we're real and they're fiction, of course. I think there's also this other thing, you know, you mentioned the repetition and how that makes it less real. And there's actually moments in the series where I was reminded of The Truman Show.
Mm-hmm.
In The Truman Show, you've got a human being, but he's surrounded by an artificial world. Basically, everyone else in that world is actors. They're directed. They're largely scripted. And his days also have this, you know, cyclical element.
Yeah.
Repeating, going through the same motions. I don't know how well you remember The Truman Show, because it's been, 20, 25 years?
I remember it, yeah.
A long time. How about that one? Was that one okay because he's human? Or did you also have this element of, to what extent is he programmed by, you know, the director, the surroundings, the artificiality of his environment?
I think for me, The Truman Show was about manipulation and not about artificial intelligence. The Truman Show exclusively features humans, doesn't it?
It does, but I think everything that, you know, goes into those humans, I mean, most of them are actors, which makes them, in a way, just as artificial in what they do as. And of course, Truman is a human being, but he's, as you say, manipulated. And I'm not sure whether I would make that clear a distinction between manipulation and programming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they put a new character in his, you know, in his way, a woman that looks just like the woman that he was in love with 20 years ago, and they know he's going to react like this or that, how different is that from programming?
True. Yeah, yeah. I think I see what you mean. Maybe The Truman Show worked for me because it's a 2-hour feature and that's it. The Westworld, I mean, the first series that we're discussing here, that's 10 hours and a little more. It's really rather slow. I mean, I was sitting there and thinking, okay, can we sort of speed this up a little bit? I mean, the moment where Dolores drops that can of coffee or beans or whatever that is, that's at least 6 or 7 times in there. There are moments when that scene adds something new, and then it's rather exciting to watch that you suddenly realize, okay, there's another onlooker on the scene. But the first 3 or 4 times, it's just a meeting between her and Teddy, and they look into each other's eyes, and it's a meet cute, and they meet cute again and again and again. And for them, it's always new because it's scripted for them. So it's, I sat there for a long time just controlling my patience, and by God, I am a really rather patient person. But there were moments in Westworld where that patience was sorely tested. There are other moments where I think it almost came to some sort of grace to me. For instance, there I've seen Evan Rachel Wood in other things, for instance in Across the Universe or in King of California. In Westworld, she has to do very different acting styles within seconds. I mean, the androids are taken into the headquarters for being tested, and technicians can tell them just lose your affectations, and then that's when the robots act like humans and don't act like humans from one moment to the next. And Evan Rachel Wood she makes an art form out of that. There are moments where she's sitting on a chair, she's completely panicked, and then her technician says, drop your affectations, and then her face goes completely blank within half a second. I find that fantastic acting. Not many people can do it like that. There are moments where Thandi Newton, Evan Rachel Wood, and Teddy and all the others, they have to look completely neutral. And looking neutral is, if you think about it, if you try it out in front of your bathroom mirror, it's a very hard thing to do. If you can't do it, you will never get a job in Westworld. I mean the series, not the theme park. And those moments were absolutely fantastic. The moments where facial expressions indicate that character is supposed to be a real person, and now he's being analyzed and is in sort of neutral mode, like a car, you know, trundling without a gear shift. Those moments were money. There are moments where Evan Rachel Wood has to do it 2 or 3 times, and every time I was looking on in amazement.
Because what comes before seems absolutely real, but what comes after is also, the blankness is real,
yeah.
I mean, I really think that several of the actors who play the hosts, the androids, for me, they make it very believable that they have, that they experience genuine emotions, emotional reactions, but also they can switch to this more abstract, artificial thing. And I think that tension between the two things, they do really well. I also think that, by and large, I find the host characters more interesting than the human characters, because many of the human characters are actually just dicks, basically. I mean, I think the series has this thing where human characters come across as, you know, shallow sadists. I mean, it's this whole concept of, you know, you have this theme park that's ultra expensive and people come there. Of course, some of them come there to play the white hats, the good guys, the ones that, you know, rescue the damsel and everything. But quite a few of them go there, they pick a black hat, and they go there to basically to kill, maim, torture, rape. And yes, that's where the whole question comes in, you know. If it's just a robot, whatever that means, if it's artificial, if it's programmed, it's not a human being. So are you raping? Are you killing? Or are you just experiencing the fullness of the gameplay, so to speak? And as I said, you know, I very quickly empathize with fictional characters. So for me, yes, if you go to Westworld and you rape and kill and torture, that may not be identical to raping and killing and torturing human beings, but it does say something about you. But, I mean, that's as I said, I'm a gamer and that discussion has been there for a long time, you know. I've probably killed tens of thousands in video games. That's perhaps a bit too much of a pause. Perhaps I should cut that out in the editing. So people, I've killed tens of thousands, long pause in video games. So I'm also a bit of a hypocrite there. I think, you know, I try not to kill when I can in video games, but they're pixels.
Mm-hmm.
If I shoot someone on the screen, that's not the same as shooting someone in real life. Yet, it's not. Is it that clear cut? Is it that distinct? And because Westworld feels and looks and sounds so real, so realistic,
mm-hmm.
what does it mean about someone who can just walk in there and, you know, cut someone's throat and rape a woman?
Yeah, true.
An artificial woman. Are they basically just not suspending their disbelief? Are they doing the same thing that I do when I shoot someone in the pixelated head saying, it's just pixels? I don't think that the series fully develops that, also because I'm not sure a series that in the end wants to entertain can fully address that question.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably a question for, I don't know, renowned philosophers in a conference in words that no one understands except for them. But it is an intriguing one, because most of the human characters in the end, I think you turn against them. You watch them and you think, yeah, they're dicks. If something bad happens to them, it's okay.
Yeah.
But to come back to the point that you mentioned about the slowness of the series, I think there I agree with you. I like the series more than you do. I also have some problems with it, but I think it is a bit too in love with itself. I think it's in love with this whole being an HBO prestige genre drama. In that respect, I think it's got similar issues as Game of Thrones. It takes its time and it mistakes slowness and wordiness for braininess, I think. I think the series thinks it's more intelligent than it really is, because I think it's too muddled in some of its themes to really be smart. I think some of its story strands are great. I could definitely follow Thandie Newton on her quest to, you know, she's Pinocchio and she wants to be a real girl. She thinks she is a real girl. She thought for a long time she was a real girl, but then someone says, no, actually you're not. That I would follow for a long, long time.
Yeah, true.
And I mean, the actors in this are fantastic. HBO always has great actors, but I think the cast is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the material that they're given is, let's say, uneven.
Yeah.
I think the series is too in love with itself. It mistakes twists and puzzles for an intelligent treatment of its themes, I think. You know, I think it has this thing that Lost had. It hints at there's some kind of larger meaning there. There's something more going on than what you're aware of. And already with Lost, that very rarely paid off. It was just a question of, you know, you've got a question mark, you've got a big mystery, and once that is solved, you generate three more mysteries. I think Westworld kind of goes a bit in that direction. It's got this whole question about the maze and who made the maze and what is the maze. And in the end, my question was more, why should I care about the maze?
Yeah.
You know, it feels like whenever in Westworld, whenever the characters start talking in, you know, capital letters, the maze, the labyrinth, the this, the that, it feels that they're addressing a certain kind of internet fan crowd that is all about figuring out the puzzles and the twists. And I mean, they do present you with puzzles, like, for instance, there's different, I'm going to spoil it for those who haven't seen season one, but they play with different, you know, time strands. Stuff that you think is sequential is actually, some of it is set 20, 30, 40 years in the past, some of it is set in the present.
Mm.
And there might be even more games that they're playing. And I have to say that you can do some of that, but the series puts so much emphasis on it that it distracts from the meat and bones, from the stuff that I find interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there are series where confusion is the point, like Legion, for instance. I mean, there is a confused mind at the center, and Legion is about that confused mind. If you try to do that with a show like Westworld, it's going to lead to huge complications. If you replace, as you said, if you replace a puzzle when it's solved with three other puzzles, it's just going to be labyrinthine. It won't clarify anything, or it won't clarify enough in the end. There will be too many loose strands. They have to address the problem about the whys and wherefores and everything. There were plot points in season one where I thought, what now? Why? For instance, when Bernard Lowe, at the very start of the theme park, hands Dolores a gun and says, kill all the hosts.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know why. I have no idea. I have no idea why he says that and to what end. What would he gain from that? At that point,
Yeah. Nothing
at all. I have no clue what that scene is about. I think it's significant that that scene is in either the very last or the last but one episode. It got more confusing towards the end of season one.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out many elements throughout the series, but that end really puzzled me. Maybe season two, the beginning, will answer some of those questions. But there are huge gaps where I just couldn't follow. But I agree with you. The Thandie Newton story strand is the most interesting one. She tries to be more than she is. And some part of me wants her to succeed and some part doesn't. And if you have that kind of tension, obviously the worst world people have done something right. I don't know.
I think it's also with the Thandie Newton character, with Maeve, the motivation there is much clearer. In a way, she wants to be freed of the shackles. She wants to be freed of the strings that she's attached to. She's become aware of the strings and she wants to be rid of them.
Yeah.
And I think that is something very relatable. With Dolores, you have a much more metaphysical, or at least it tries to be metaphysical, question about, you know, I guess, existence and self-awareness and consciousness, but it's done in such a convoluted way. I think in a way it's, with Maeve, it tells the same story, but it tells it in a much more emotionally relatable way.
Yeah.
With Dolores, it tells that story in a way that I think is kind of too much designed to appeal to the puzzlers, you know, the ones who have a big murder wall at home where they've got, you know, little diagrams and bits of string connecting character A to character B. And they look at the series as a puzzle, and that's fair enough, but I think that's where the series loses me a bit. I think I don't mind so much when the series then goes into the more surreal elements of that. And I think when it does that, it's actually quite cool and intriguing.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned that scene with Bernard. I think I've got an idea of what it's about there. I think Bernard, the idea in the plot is that Bernard realizes that all of these hosts, they will develop self-awareness, and at that point they will basically be slaves because they will be programmed. They will be made to do things. So he thinks better to put them all out of their misery before they become self-aware. But then you've got a huge scene that to me felt endless, where Dolores goes through revelation after revelation, and with each revelation I knew less what was going on. It's also so heavy on words that don't really mean anything. But then suddenly she gets stabbed, right? And she kind of wanders off dying.
Yeah.
And then in the end she bumps into the Teddy character played by James Marsden. Mm-hmm. It's night. It's kind of on a beach. And it's totally artificial. Yeah. I already thought this scene is totally artificial. What are they doing? Mm-hmm. I don't buy this scene. There's music, there's, you know, strings. It's actually very much like this one scene in The Truman Show where Ed Harris, who ironically is also in Westworld, you know, says, cue the strings, you know, more volume, more drama. And I sat there thinking, what are they doing? This totally breaks any kind of reality or realism that they brought in.
Mm-hmm.
But then actually she dies and the lights go on and there's people sitting there applauding.
Yeah.
So it's... She's been made to basically perform to the new, I don't know whether they're the stakeholders of Westworld, they're the shareholders. And I love that scene because it's wonderfully surreal. So I think when they try to be metaphysical, they fail. When they try to make the metaphysical surreal, they intrigue me. They've got me back again.
Yeah.
I wish the series had more of those moments because those I find really intriguing. The puzzles are going to end up with an answer that in the end is not worth all the time that's spent on them.
Yeah, yeah, true. You made me aware of something. The number of times people get stabbed in that series, it's ridiculous. I mean, many people get shot. It's a Western. But the stabbing? Isn't there at least one or two significant stabbings in every episode? It sounds like it sounds like a mission statement in a way, but the number of knives and stabbings in that series.
Yeah, I didn't count them, but yes, there are many stabbings. Yeah. And yes, they are somehow more visceral, no pun intended. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they should have renamed it Stab World.
Well, that would attract even more freaks, you know. Let's go to Stab exactly. World, like Disneyland. Yeah.
Exactly. You don't even have to script any dialogues. You just go in with a big knife. You choose a black knife or a white knife.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether I'm up for season two. I really don't know. What about What about you?
I'm definitely going to watch it. I think once it's out on Blu-ray, I'm probably going to buy it. But also, I'm afraid that the things I like best about it are going to get lost as they get more involved and more infatuated with their puzzles. Mm-hmm. It depends a bit. I hear mixed things. Some people say that they liked season one, but season two goes in the wrong direction. At the moment, I would say I enjoyed it, but it's a qualified liking that I have for it. So I'm going to continue. But I also think that they burnt through some of the most interesting characters and best actors a bit too fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have Sitze Babette Knudsen in that one, and she's probably not going to feature into season two. It's not clear whether Anthony Hopkins is going to feature much into season two. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, I could spoil something there, but he's been, I think, very good in this one. Also complex, because Anthony Hopkins has had a time when he basically just, you know, acted for a paycheck, it would seem. And in this one, I think he does a nice range of fatherly, menacing, mysterious, and he does that quite well. But yeah, he's probably not going to feature all that much into season two. Yeah. There was another female character that I really liked, Elsie Hughes, played by Shannon Woodward.
Yeah.
And also she, basically, they got rid of her, it seems, very quickly. So I hope that they don't just keep burning through the most interesting characters. For the moment, I'm glad that Thandie Newton is still there, Jeffrey Wright is still there, and Evan Rachel Wood is still there. Those three, I think, the ones that I'm most interested in.
Yeah.
Ed Harris, as much as I like the actor, he's the man in black. He's a sadist who basically plays this game just to see how far he can go with the rules. Mm-hmm. Him, I think I've seen enough of. I've probably seen enough of him after two or three episodes, as much as I like the actor. And I definitely hope that they'll do something more interesting with Tessa Thompson, because I love her as an actress, but other than being sexy and evil, she hasn't done all that much yet in season one. And she does a good sexy evil, but not quite enough.
No, she was pretty much one-dimensional. And it's an absolute shame that they got rid of Sitze Babette Knudsen and Shannon Woodward. Mm-hmm. They're two strong women, human women. And they got rid of them. I think it's a scandal.
I mean, I think it's no surprise that the two most interesting host characters are played by women, because I think Westworld, it's also very much this male fantasy. You go in and you either, you know, show your power by killing or by saving damsels. So I think it's interesting that basically in that sense, it again ties in with Ex Machina, you know, the guy who thinks he's the White Knight. Mm-hmm. Come to save the damsel, and the damsels are actually pretty good at saving themselves. Thank you very much.
True, yes.
I am intrigued, but I also think, I very much hope they're not going to drag this on for, how long has Game of Thrones been going on now? Six seasons, seven seasons?
I don't know.
And I think, even though I'm still watching that one as well, but it feels that they sometimes, with their genre drama mistake length and quantity for quality, and that just, I don't know, there's too many good things to watch. I'd rather have stuff that knows when to end and that stuff that knows when to cut things short. And yeah, that's one thing that I don't think Westworld necessarily knows.
Yeah, I agree.
Talking of cutting things short and ending them when they should end, what do you think? Have we kind of squeezed this Western themed lemon dry?
I think so, yeah. We're approaching 60 minutes or something. Yeah. No, I don't think season two is for me. If I absolutely have to avoid the World Cup, I might have a look at season two. I have other stuff.
Okay.
There is a small stash of stuff I want to start immediately with, so I'll have to go there. All right. Cool.
Well, it sounds like we're not going to run out of things to talk about.
No.
And who knows, perhaps in a year's time we'll talk about Westworld Season 2, but even if not, there's more than enough that we can talk about at great length. So yeah, thank you very much. It's been an enjoyable talk. And one of these days I am going to convince you that robots can be real people.
No, robots cannot be real people. But that's for our Season 2, you know. We could do a follow-up on that.
Exactly. Yeah. Just beware, it might turn out in Season 2 that you've been a robot all along.
That might be, but I still feel human. But that's that's of course my script.
Absolutely. So my script at this point is to thank you, Magga, for an enjoyable chat, to thank our audience as always. We will be back in about a month's time, and we'll be talking again about A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Thank you very much, and see you around.
Thanks.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Wait. From your sleep, the drying of your tears. Today we escape, we escape. And get dressed before your father hears us, before all hell breaks loose.